Well, in a moment, Hannah's going to come and bring this morning's reading. But before she does, I just want to give you a few questions to be considering. We've got quite a long reading this morning. It's narrative, so it's quite easy to follow. But our tendency is to drift off when the Bible's read. It's a peculiar thing we do, but this is what we do. So hopefully the questions will keep us focused on what's being said. So we're going to read the last chapter of 1 Samuel, just to give us a bit of context. Then we're going to read 2 Samuel 1 to 4. And just a few things for you to be considering. So the first thing is how does the account of Saul's death in 1 Samuel 31 differ from the account of Saul's death in 2 Samuel 1? And then the second thing, throughout 2 Samuel 1 to 4, a lot of people are killed. Who's killed and who are they killed by? And then the final thing is, those people who are killed, how do they relate to David? So basically, who's getting killed, who are they getting killed by, and how do those people who are getting killed relate to David? So a couple of things to be thinking about. Hannah's now going to come and bring our reading.
So we'll be starting at 1 Samuel 31. So that's found on page 252. And then, as Tom said, reading to 2 Samuel chapter 4. Okay. Now the Philistines were fighting against Israel, and the men of Israel fled before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines overtook Saul and his sons, and the Philistines struck down Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua, the sons of Saul. The battle pressed hard against Saul, and the archers found him, and he was badly wounded by the archers. Then Saul said to his armor-bearer, "Draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through and mistreat me." But his armor-bearer would not, for he feared greatly. Therefore Saul took his own sword and fell upon it. And when his armor-bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell upon his sword and died with him. Thus Saul died, and his three sons, and his armor-bearer, and all his men on the same day together. And when the men of Israel who were on the other side of the valley, and those beyond the Jordan, saw that the men of Israel had fled, and that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned their cities and fled, and the Philistines came and lived in them. The next day, when the Philistines came to strip the slain, they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. So they took off his head and stripped off his armor and sent messengers throughout the land of the Philistines to carry the good news to the house of their idols and to the people. They put his armor in the temple of Ashtaroth, and they fastened his body to the wall of Bethshan. But when the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men arose and went all night and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Bethshan. And they came to Jabesh and burned them there. And they took their bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree in Jabesh and fasted for 7 days. After the death of Saul, when David had returned from striking down the Amalekites, David remained 2 days in Ziklag. And on the third day, behold, a man from Saul's camp with his came a man from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dirt on his head. And when he came to David, he fell to the ground and paid homage. David said to him, "Where do you come from?" And he said to him, "I have escaped from the camp of Israel." And David said to him, "How did it go? Tell me." And he answered, "The people fled from the battle, and also many of the people have fallen and are dead. And Saul and his son Jonathan are also dead." Then David said to the young man who told him, "How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead?" And the young man who told him said, "By chance I happened to be on Mount Gilboa, and there was Saul leaning on his spear. And behold, the chariots and the horsemen were close upon him. And when he looked behind him, he saw me and called to me. And I answered, "Here I am." And he said to me, "Who are you?" I answered him, "I am an Amalekite." And he said to me, "Stand beside me and kill me, for anguish has seized me, and yet my life still lingers." So I stood beside him and killed him, because I was sure that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown that was on his head and the armlet that was on his arm, and I have brought them here to my lord. Then David took hold of his clothes and tore them, and so did all the men who were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and for Jonathan his son, and for the people of the Lord, and for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. And David said to the young man who told him, "Where do you come from?" And he answered, "I am the son of a sojourner, an Amalekite." David said to him, "How is it that you were not afraid to put out your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" Then David called one of the young men and said, "Go, execute him." And he struck him down so that he died. And David said to him, "Your blood be on your head, for your own mouth has testified against you, saying, 'I have killed the Lord's anointed.'" And David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and Jonathan his son. And he said, "It should be taught to the people of Judah. Behold, it is written in the book of Jasher." He said, "Your glory, O Israel, is slain on your high places. How the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath. Publish it not in the streets of Ashkelon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised exult. You mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew or rain upon you, nor fields of offerings. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul not anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, from the bow of Jonathan turn not back, and the sword of Saul returned not empty. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and lovely, in life and in death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. You daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you luxuriously in scarlet, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel. How the mighty have fallen in the midst of the battle. Jonathan lies slain on your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant you have been to me. Your love to me was extraordinary, surpassing the love of women. How the mighty have fallen and the weapons of war perished." After this, David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go up into any of the cities of Judah?" And the Lord said to him, "Go up." David said, "To which shall I go up?" And he said, "To Hebron." So David went up there, and his two wives also, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. And David brought up his men who were with him, everyone with his household, and they lived in the towns of Hebron. And the men of Judah came, and they were anointed, and there they anointed King David over the house of Judah. When they told David it was the men of Jabesh Gilead who buried Saul, David sent messengers to the men of Jabesh Gilead and said to him, "May you be blessed by the Lord, because you showed this loyalty to Saul your Lord and buried him. Now may the Lord show steadfast love and faithfulness to you, and I will do good to you because you have done this thing. Now therefore let your hands be strong and be valiant, for Saul your Lord is dead, and the house of Judah has anointed me king over them." But Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, took Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim. And he made him king over Gilead and the Asherites and Jezreel and Ephraim and Benjamin and all Israel. Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he began to reign over Israel. And he reigned for 2 years. But the house of Judah followed David. And the time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. Abner the son of Ner and the servants of Ish-bosheth the son of Saul went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon. And Joab the son of Zeruiah, the servants of David, went out and met them at the pool of Gibeon. And they sat down, one on one side of the pool and the other on the other side of the pool. And Abner said to Joab, "Let the young men arise and compete before us." And Joab said, "Let them arise." Then they arose and passed over by number, 12 for Benjamin and Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, and 12 of the servants of David. And each caught his opponent by the head and thrust his sword in the opponent's side so that they fell down together. Therefore that place was called Helkath Hazurim, which is at Gibeon. And the battle was very fierce that day. And Abner and the men of Israel were beaten before the servants of David. And the three sons of Zeruiah were there, Joab, Abishai, and Asahel. Now Asahel was swift of foot as a wild gazelle, and Asahel pursued Abner. And as he went, he turned neither to the right nor to the left from following Abner. Then Abner looked behind him and said, "Is it you, Asahel?" And he answered, "It is I." Abner said, "Turn aside to your right hand or to your left, and seize one of the young men and take his spoil." But Asahel would not turn aside from following him. And Abner said again to Asahel, "Turn aside from following me. Why should I strike you to the ground? How then could I lift up my face to your brother Joab?" But he refused to turn aside. Therefore, Abner struck him in the stomach with the butt of his spear, so that the spear came out at his back, and he fell there and died where he was. And all who came to the place where Asahel had fallen and died stood still. But Joab and Abishai pursued Abner, and the sun was going down, and they came to the hill of Amnah, which lies before Gia, on the way to the wilderness of Gibeon. And the people of Benjamin gathered themselves together behind Abner and became one group, and took their stand on the top of the hill. Then Abner called to Joab, "Shall the sword devour forever? Do you not know that the end will be bitter? How long will it be before you tell your people to turn from the pursuit of their brothers?" And Joab said, "As God lives, if you had not spoken, surely the men would not have given up the pursuit of their brothers until morning." So Joab blew the trumpet, and all the men stopped and pursued Israel no more, nor did they fight any more. And Abner and his men went all that night through Arabah. They crossed the Jordan, and marching the whole morning, they came to Mahanaim. Joab returned from the pursuit of Abner, and when he had gathered all the people together, there were missing from David's servants 19 men besides Asahel. But the servants of David had struck down of Benjamin 360 of Abner's men, and they took up Asahel and buried him in the tomb of his father, which was at Bethlehem. And Joab and his men marched all night, and the day broke upon them at Hebron. There was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. And David grew stronger and stronger, while the house of Saul became weaker and weaker. And the sons were born to David at Hebron. His firstborn was Amnon of Ahinoam of Jezreel, and his second, Chileab of Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. And the third, Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. And the fourth, Adonijah, the son of Haggith. And the fifth, Shephatah, the son of Abital. And the sixth, Ithream of Eglah, David's wife. These were born to David in Hebron. While there was a war between the house of Saul and the house of David, Abner was making himself strong in the house of Saul. Now Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. And Ish-bosheth said to Abner, "Why have you gone into my father's concubine?" Then Abner was very angry over the words of Ish-bosheth and said, "Am I a dog's head of Judah? To this day I keep showing steadfast love to the house of Saul, your father, to his brothers and to his friends, and have not given you into the hand of David, and yet you charge me today with a fault concerning a woman. God do so to Abner, and also more, if I do not accomplish for David what the Lord has sworn to him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and set up the throne of David over Israel and over Judah, from Dan to Beersheba, And Ish-bosheth could not answer Abner another word, because he feared him. And Abner sent messengers to David on his behalf, saying, "To whom does the land belong? Make your covenant with me, and behold, my hand shall be with you to bring over all Israel to you." And he said, "Good, I will make a covenant with you. But one thing I require of you, that is, you shall not see my face unless you first bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see my face." Then David sent messengers to Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, saying, "Give me my wife Michal, for whom I paid the bridal price of 100 foreskins of the Philistines." And Ish-bosheth sent and took her from her husband, Paltiel, the son of Laish. But her husband went with her, weeping after her all the way to Bahurim. Then Abner said to him, "Go, return." And he returned. And Abner conferred with the elders of Israel, saying, "For some time past you have been seeking David as king over you. Now then, bring it about, for the Lord has promised David, saying, 'By the hand of my servant David, I will save my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines and from the hand of all their enemies.'" Abner also spoke to Benjamin. And Abner went to David to tell David at Hebron that Israel and the whole house of Benjamin thought good to do. When Abner came with 20 men to David at Hebron, David made a feast for Abner and the men who were with him. And Abner said to David, "I will arise and go and will gather all Israel to my lord the king, that they may make a covenant with you, and that you may reign over all that your heart desires." So David sent Abner away, and he went in peace. Just then, the servants of David arrived with Joab from a raid, bringing much spoil with them. But Abner was not with David at Hebron, for he had sent him away, and he had gone in peace. When Joab and all the army that was with him came, it was told Joab, "Abner, the son of Ner, came to the king, and he has let him go, and he has gone in peace." Then Joab went to the king and said, "What have you done? Behold, Abner came to you. Why is it that you have sent him away so that he is gone? You know that Abner, the son of Ner, came to deceive you, and to know your going out and your coming in, and to know all that you are doing." When Joab came out from David's presence, he sent messengers after Abner, and they brought him back from the cistern of Sirah. But David did not know about it. And when Abner returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside in the midst of the gate to speak with him privately, and there he struck him in the stomach so that he died, for the blood of Asahel, his brother. Afterwards, when David heard of it, he said, "I and my kingdom are forever guiltless before the Lord, for the blood of Abner and the son of Ner. May it fall upon the head of Joab and upon his father's house, and may the house of Joab never be without one who has a discharge, or who is leprous, or who holds a spindle, or who falls by the sword, or who lacks bread." So Joab and Abishai his brother killed Abner, because he had put their brother Asahel to death in the battle at Gibeon. Then David said to Joab and all the people who were with him, "Tear your clothes and put sackcloth on and mourn before Abner." And King David followed the bier. They buried Abner at Hebron, and the king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner, and all the people wept. And the king lamented for Abner, saying, "Should Abner die as a fool dies? Your hands were not bound, your feet were not fettered, as one falls before the wicked, you have fallen." And all the people wept again over him. And then all the people came to persuade David to eat bread while it was yet day. But David swore, saying, "God do so to me and more also if I taste bread or anything else till the sun goes down." And all the people took notice of it, and it pleased them, as everything that the king did pleased all the people. So all the people and all Israel understood that day that it had not been the king's will to put to death Abner, the son of Ner. And the king said to his servants, "Do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel? And I was gentle today, though anointed king. These men, "These sons of Zeruiah are more severe than I. The Lord repay the evildoer according to his wickedness." When Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, heard that Abner had died at Hebron, his courage failed, and all Israel was dismayed. Now Saul's son had two men who were captains of raiding bands. The name of one was Banah, and the name of the other, Rechab, sons of Rimmon, a man of Benjamin from Beeroth, for Beeroth is also counted part of Benjamin. The Beerothites fled to Gittim and have been sojourners there to this day. Jonathan, the son of Saul, had a son who was crippled in his feet. He was 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel, and his nurse took him up and fled. As she fled in her haste, he fell and became lame, and his name was Mephibosheth. Now the sons of Rimmon, the Beerothite, Rechab and Banah, set out, and about the heat of the day they came to the house of Ish-bosheth, as he was taking his noonday rest. And they came into the midst of the house as if to get wheat, and they stabbed him in the stomach. Then Rechab and Banah his brother escaped. When they came into the house as he lay on his bed in his bedroom, they struck him and put him to death and beheaded him. They took his head and went by the way of Arabah all night, and brought the head of Ish-bosheth to David at Hebron. And they said to the king there, "Here is the head of Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy, who sought your life. The Lord avenged my lord, the king, this day on Saul and on his offspring." But David answered Rechab and Banah his brother, the sons of Rimmon the Beerothite, "As the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life out of every adversity? When one told me, 'Behold, Saul is dead,' and thought he was bringing good news, I seized him and killed him at Ziklag, which was the reward I gave him for his news. How much more, when the wicked men have killed a righteous man in his own house, on his bed, shall I not now require his blood at your hand and destroy you from the earth?" And David commanded his young men, and they killed him and cut off their hands and feet and hanged them beside the pool at Hebron. But they took the head of Ish-bosheth and buried it in the tomb of Abner at Hebron.
Well, thank you, Hannah. We're going to have a look at that passage in a moment. But before we do, let me just mention, at the end of the sermon, there's going to be an opportunity to ask any questions or make any comments in light of what we've been studying. Obviously, I'm not going to be able to comment on everything. There's a lot going on there. I'll try and comment on most things, some things. But if there's something that's particularly made you think, oh, I'd be interested to know a little bit more about that, then obviously at the end, when the question comes up, there's an opportunity to ask about that. Or it might be simply clarification on some of the things that we have been thinking about in light of the passage. But before we do any of that, let's first ask God to help us. Dear Heavenly Father, we do thank you that we have this record of your Messiah. We do pray, Lord, as we reflect on this morning, this peculiar time when there are two kings in Israel, both who are professing, or both who truly are your anointed ones. We pray, Lord, that we would be better able to understand this conundrum this morning. And as we do this, we would be better able to understand how these anointed ones pointed to your son, Jesus, who is now our Messiah. Amen. Well, today we begin 2 Samuel. And an obvious question that you'll all be thinking is, what happened to 1 Samuel? Well, some of you may remember we have studied 1 Samuel on a Sunday morning, but can you believe it? It was back in the summer of 2013, and it only feels like yesterday. So given this, as we begin 2 Samuel, it's going to be necessary to remind ourselves a little bit of the situation of 1 Samuel. Okay, so we'll be doing that a little bit in a moment. But as we begin 2 Samuel, the context is Saul is dead. And so you can imagine the people saying, "The king is dead, long live the king." But why do people say that? Is it because the subjects want to get on the right side of the new king as quickly as possible? And so this remark, "The king is dead, long live the king," is a remark of respect for the new king. Well, there is another possibility. A long life for the king brings stable times for the people. Because every time the king dies, there is an inevitable time of unrest. When the king is dead, there is just enough confusion for potential usurpers to contest for the throne. And this is the transition period that Israel finds itself in this passage. Saul is dead, so is his son Jonathan. So the question is, who will be king? Well, it's here where things actually get even a little more complicated. And we need to know a little bit of the background of what has gone on before. Now, Israel was a peculiar nation, and it was peculiar for all sorts of reasons. But the one that one that we're interested in today is that in the past, Israel had no king. Now, the reason Israel had no king was because God was Israel's king. So Israel was to serve God as their king. However, this is not what happened. Israel soon forgot about their God, their king. And you can read the account of this in the book of Judges. God is forgotten about. And as you read through the book of Judges, the people of Israel spiral further and further down into further and further disgrace until they get to the point where they almost wipe out a whole of one of the tribes. And in the book of Judges, the refrain keeps cropping up. The people had no king, and so everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Now, the book of 1 Samuel follows on from the book of Judges. And in chapter 8 of 1 Samuel, the people come to Samuel and they say, "Behold, you are old. Your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint for us a king. Appoint for us a king to judge us like all the nations." At this point, Samuel feels rejected. But God corrects him. God says this: "Obey the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over you." Now, at this point, it seems to me this raises an important question. Were the people wrong to ask for a king? And that question is complicated, and it's complicated for the following reasons. We've just seen that by asking for a king, they have rejected God as king. However, we also know that Israel did eventually have a king, and Israel having a king is an extremely significant turning point in redemptive history, since the king of Israel, or the Messiah, anticipates when Jesus will step into this role. So, were they wrong to ask for a king, or were they right to ask for a king? I mean, one option, which surely can't be right, is that God didn't intend for Israel to ask for a king. Only when they did ask for a king, they took him by surprise. At which point he thinks, "Well, okay, maybe I can use this for my advantage." Well, in order to consider this possibility, we need to turn back to Deuteronomy 17, verses 14 to 20. And if you're using the church Bibles, it's on page 160. And it says this. So Deuteronomy 17, verse 14. When you come to the land that Lord your God is giving you, and you possess it and dwell in it, and then say, I will set a king over me, like all the nations around me, you may indeed set a king over you, whom the Lord your God will choose. One from among your brothers you shall set as king over you. You may not put a foreigner over you, who is not your brother, only he who must not acquire many horses for himself, or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to acquire many horses. Since the Lord has said to you, you shall never return the way that way again. And he shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he acquire for himself excessive silver and gold. And when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself in a book a copy of his law approved by the Levitical priest, and it shall be with him, and he shall read in it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by keeping all the words of this law and these statutes and doing them. And his heart may not be lifted up above his brothers, that he may not turn aside from the commandment, either to the right hand or to the left, so that he may continue long in his kingdom, he and his children in Israel. So not only did God anticipate the people asking for a king, but he welcomed it. So in verse 15 we read, you may indeed set a king over you. Now it's what follows in verse 15 that's significant and determines whether or not the people have gone about it the correct way or in asking for a king have rejected God as king. So verse 15, you may indeed set a king over you, whom the Lord your God will choose. You're free to set a king over you. However, the king you set over you is to be chosen by God. You're not to choose the king that you would set over you. This is extremely helpful because as we read 1 Samuel, we see the people have chosen their own king. So 1 Samuel 8, verse 18, Samuel in that passage describes how the king will be a hard taskmaster. And he goes on to say, and in that day you will cry out because of your king who you have chosen for yourselves. Saul is that king. Saul is the king they chose. And it should have been clear from the very start that he was a bad choice. Do you remember what Saul was doing when he was first introduced? He'd lost his donkeys. He isn't a very good shepherd. So if he's not a very good shepherd, why would we expect him to be a good king? The only characteristic that we're ever given of Saul is that he's tall. It says, when he stood up among the people, he was taller than any of the other people from his shoulder upwards. Now, if you work your way through the Bible, being tall is not a good sign. We might think it's good, but the only other time height is mentioned is when the safety and integrity of Israel is threatened. So do you remember when the spies come back from the promised land? They're scared because the people are so tall and they themselves feel like grasshoppers. And of course, the most well-known tall person in the Bible is the Philistine Goliath. Saul is tall and it's a warning that Israel is not in safe hands. And of course, this is fulfilled. It's not long before Saul rebels against God. And Samuel says to him, but now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart. Now we know this refers to David. And no doubt we're used to the idea that this means David had the heart of God. But given that all that we've said so far, it makes much more sense to understand that God has chosen David according to his heart. David is God's chosen king. He is the one who is God's choice. He is the one after his own heart. Saul is the people's choice. So, if you like, Saul is the one after the people's heart. David is God's choice, the one after God's own heart. Now, this helps explain the situation of 2 Samuel 1 to 4. It helps to explain why there are two kings in Israel, both having been anointed by God. And of course, when we arrive in 2 Samuel chapter 1, Saul is dead, his son Jonathan is dead, and the only possible heirs that remain are Ishbosheth and Jonathan's son Mephibosheth. Now, there are a few other significant characters. There is Abner, who is the commander of Saul's army. Then there is David, God's choice. And another character is Joab, who is the commander of David's army. And when we come to 2 Samuel chapters 2 and 3, notice the two chapters in the middle, it draws our attention to Abner and Joab. And theirs is a peculiar story. See, Abner is on Saul's side. He commands Saul's army. And with the loss of Saul and Jonathan, his efforts are to install Ishbosheth, Saul's other son, as king over Israel. So if we wanted to try and put this simply, we might be thinking Abner appears to be the baddie. Whereas Joab, he is on David's side. His commitment is that David become the king over Israel. So, Joab appears to be the goodie. In chapter 2, Joab and Abner go to battle. And Joab's army strike down 360 of Abner's men, while Joab only loses 20 men. And as we read on, David's kingdom becomes stronger and stronger, while Saul's kingdom becomes weaker and weaker. And did you notice in chapter 3, verses 2 to 6, David has a number of sons. And this illustrates the strength of his kingdom as he has descendant upon descendant upon descendant who have the potential to step in his place if and when he is killed. He's going from strength to strength, and Saul's dynasty is going from weakness, weaker and weaker. So Joab appears to be getting the better of Abner. But as I say, things are a little bit more complicated once again. Though Joab killed more than Abner, he killed 360 men to Abner's 20 men, Abner kills Joab's brother. Now, Joab's brother intended to kill Abner. I mean, they were in a battle. And so when Abner was faced with Asahel, he had no choice but to kill him. But Joab takes this personally. And as the story unfolds, Abner and Ishbosheth have an argument, which leads to Abner promising to hand over the kingdom of Israel to David. So effectively, Abner swaps sides. The news of this David welcomes, and Abner is given safe passage. But Joab, for obvious reasons, takes exception to this. He arranges to meet Abner, and his motivation is to kill him in order to avenge his brother. Now, David's conclusion is revealing. Despite Joab having killed the commander of his enemy's army, David curses Joab, and in his lament for Abner, he blesses him. we see Joab is seen to be the wicked one, while Abner is seen to be the righteous one. Now, of course, Abner's death sets things in motion for Ishbosheth's murder and David becoming king. Now, did you notice that chapter 4 parallels chapter 1? So in 2 Samuel 1, an Amalekite comes with good news. I have killed Saul. And then in chapter 4, Banah and Rechab come with good news. We have killed Ishbosheth. Now, David himself observes these similarities. Have a look at 2 Samuel 4, 8 to 11. So, Banah and Rechab bring the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron. And they said to the king, here is the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy who sought your life. The Lord has avenged my lord, the king, this day on Saul and on his offspring. But David answered Rechab and Banah, his brother, the sons of Rinnom, the Berahothite. As the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life out of every adversity, when one told me, behold, Saul is dead, and thought he was bringing me good news, I seized him and killed him at Ziklag, which was the reward I gave him for his news. How much more when wicked men have killed a righteous man in his own house, on his bed, shall I not now require his blood at your hand and destroy you from the earth? And David commanded his young men, and they killed them and cut off their hands and feet. They hanged them beside the pool at Hebron, but they took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in the tomb of Abner at Hebron. So in chapter 1, David kills the Amalekite because he struck God's anointed one. He then kills Banah and Rechab because they killed a righteous man. A couple of observations. Notice David distinguishes between the two kings. Saul was the anointed one. He had been anointed by God. Whereas Ishbosheth was not. He was simply a man who was righteous. And he observes Saul was killed in battle, you know, whereas Ishbosheth was killed by his own allies in his bed. Now, as we come to the end of this morning's sermon, it's worth making a few observations of what we've seen. First of all, David was a good shepherd. And as such, as a good shepherd, he makes a good king. The events that are recorded in the first four chapters of 2 Samuel are anything but straightforward. David is faced with a number of ethical conundrums. What do you do when a man comes and says, Saul is dead? Saul had attempted to kill David numerous times. So do you reward his murderer? David is the rightful king of Israel, but Ishbosheth stands in his way. And Abner, the commander of his army, is a worthy opponent. Are you grateful then when Joab kills him? How do you treat the raiders that turn against Ishbosheth? End his life so that you are free to become king. Faced with these ethical nightmares, David judges with righteousness. I mean, think of the surprise. I mean, it would have come as a tremendous surprise to the Amalekite, to Banah and Rechab, that their news was not received favourably. I mean, otherwise they wouldn't have brought that news. Their reason for bringing their news, because they thought it was good news. They thought it was news that the king would favour. And they expect a great reward. That's their motivation. But when David hears the news, he judges with righteousness and strikes them down. The reason he does that is because he is God's chosen king. He walks in the ways of God because he is the king after God's own heart. Secondly, considering that Rechab and Baanah were motivated also by reward, from the new king, it's interesting that they both say, "The Lord has avenged my Lord." Now, back in 1 Samuel 26, it's not the one we read earlier, it's a couple of chapters later, but David has a second chance to kill Saul. And in verse 10, he says this, "As the Lord lives, the Lord will strike him, or his day will come to die, or he will go down in battle." David knows that Saul will die. However, the one thing David is sure of is it will not be by his hand. And in 1 Samuel 24 that we did read earlier, David promises Saul that he would not cut off Saul's offspring when the kingdom of Israel was his. Hence, David can agree with Rechab and Baanah. He says, "The Lord redeemed my life out of every adversity." You see, it is God who avenges, and Saul is dead. And now Ishbosheth is dead. And because of this, the kingdom is now established in David's hands. And God's will is done. And God can work his will even through the wickedness of men. And so it's only right that David gives the appropriate reward for striking down God's anointed, and the appropriate reward for striking down the son that David had promised to spare. He kills both of the culprits. God's will is done, and the kingdom is in the hand of a king chosen by God. And his king, the king chosen by God, will rule with righteousness. Let's pray. Dear Heavenly Father, we do thank you for this vivid picture of David, who is your Messiah, your chosen king, the one who you appointed after your own heart. We thank you how we can see, although he is engaged in some very difficult ethical decisions, that he rules over your people with righteousness. And we do thank you as we read through this and learn about this Messiah, that we can anticipate the day when your Messiah came, and that we know that he is a king chosen by you to rule righteously over your creation. Amen. Now then, I tried to comment on almost everything, not everything, but almost everything. So we have covered a lot. So I do appreciate there might be questions of clarification or need to expound on aspects of it, or, like I say, bits that I've not touched upon. So now is your opportunity. Yes, Susie. Yes, so I'd repeat it for the recording. So We've said, or I've said, that Saul was chosen by the people. But we also say that Saul was anointed by God. So how have we got this kind of peculiar situation? You know, was he chosen by the people or was he chosen by God? If he was chosen by the people, why was he then anointed by God? That sort of thing. Yeah, so I think it's one of those things where God's kind of saying, he's kind of a little bit like the sort of like the sentiment of Romans 1:18 to 32, where God's saying, okay, so you want a king like the other nations? You want to see what it would look like to have a king, the sort of king that you desire? Let me give you your heart's desire. Now, if we know anything about our heart's desire, our heart is the desires of our heart are not good. That's what Jesus tells us about our hearts. And so he gives them Saul, who, as we made a couple of comments about him, he is a bad shepherd. He loses his donkeys. And however, that doesn't mean that he doesn't anoint Saul and make him the king over Israel. And so he is anointed by Samuel, and he is the king over Israel, and he has great success at first, but then he fails at the point. It's at this point when he fails that God says, I'm taking the kingdom away from you. But he still remains the anointed one. He still, you know, that can't be reversed, as it were. And he still remains king over Israel. But it's at this time when David's anointed. And of course, we've got this, you know, Saul is a great foil for David because we've got this bad king compared to this good king at that point, which David is anointed, and we anticipate him becoming king. But this is the wonderful thing that we see from David. He shows great respect to Saul because he's the king of Israel. He's the anointed one by God. He's set apart to be the king of Israel. He's holy for God. Regardless of his behaviour, he's the anointed one. Regardless of the fact that Saul is after David's life, David will not touch God's anointed one. It further demonstrates his righteousness, David, in that he won't touch the anointed one, knowing that God has these things in hand. Another question? Simon. Yes.
So, was it right for him to have so many wives?
What's that? One would have been enough for him. Yes. Very good question. Yeah. So, and I think this is. Let me just make a few comments and see. I mean, I guess, interestingly, the Deuteronomy 17 comment, I guess in my mind as I'm reading that, I guess I've got particularly in mind Solomon. You know what, we know what happens to Solomon, don't we? So Solomon is David's son, and you're thinking, here is a good king. This is a high, you know, David and Solomon, these are the high points of Israel's history. You know, and it is interesting, if you read through Israel's history, there aren't as many high points as people think. Basically, this is it. The rest of it is not good. And you find that in Judges, you know, it's very bad. If you take the time to read through it, it's horrible. Horrible, horrible. Anyway, so here we've got David and Solomon, the high points of history. You know, if we get a glimpse of what it would look like in an ideal world, this is the closest you're going to get. However, Solomon's mistake is that he has too many wives. And what do? They... Well, then they're not even that he has too many wives, but he has wives from other nations. They turn him away from God. And he goes and that's what tears the two apart. So I guess the big thing to have in mind. Is that Deuteronomy 17 is what the ideal king would look like, but David and Solomon are not the ideal king, as it were. And of course, we know how Solomon comes about. His arrival, if for want of a better word, is not through the purest of methods, as it were. Obviously, I don't want to give... Well, you know what happens, so I'm not giving anything away. So, and I think this is the thing as we read through. This morning, I'm not saying to you, look at David. Isn't he a remarkable character? We should be like David. Very much not saying that. And I don't think that's a particularly helpful way to look at the Old Testament characters. Look at Abraham. We should be like Abraham. I won't be like Abraham. There's a lot of problems with Abraham. You know, look at Moses. Well, I mean, he's quite... You know, I think if we start playing that game, we get ourselves into all sorts of difficulties. Whereas what we're seeing here is that David is the Messiah. He is the anointed one. He is the Christ. And so as we get a glimpse into what this anointed one, this Messiah, this Christ, as we get a glimpse of what he is intended to do and what he does do and how his rule happens in Israel, and particularly, we mentioned in the prayers, how we've got this focus in Psalms of David. Who is David? Does he represent you and I? You know, so when I read the Psalms, I'm stealing something. This is Adrian's idea. He's not going to be bothered that I'm stealing it, but I guess I'll... he'll probably be thinking, oh, I was going to save this till we did 2 Samuel. Yeah. So, Psalm... I don't even know where I'm going with all this, but let's run with it. I think it's just because I've got something to say. I've no idea how to answer Simon's question, but I've got something.
We've all forgotten
Simon. Excellent. So it's worked. Excellent. As we read Psalm 23, you'll recognise this if you don't already know. It's a favourite psalm for everyone. I mean, if anyone knows a psalm, they know this psalm. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. What a beautiful psalm. And let me give you a warning. I'm going to spoil it for you. But then don't worry, we're going to come back on the other side, and you're going to be happy again. Okay, this is the direction we're going in. It's a wonderful psalm, and it's one of those psalms that we all learn or know of, and we take it to heart, and we read it as a personal psalm, a psalm for us. But that's not how it's intended. This is David's psalm, and this is a promise made to David. So David's saying, the Lord is my shepherd. David's saying, I shall not want. David's saying, he makes me lie down in pastures. He leads me beside still waters. Even though I'm in danger, I am walking through the valley of the shadow of death. David's saying, I'm not going to fear evil because God is with me. He's with David, and his rod and staff, they comfort me. And God is preparing David, a table for David in the presence of David's enemies. Why is David getting all this attention? It's almost as if David's a significant character in the history of redemptive history. Well, he is because he's the Messiah. And the Psalms is all about the Messiah. So yes, David is a man who does all sorts of different things like that he shouldn't do. But he's also the Messiah. And as the Messiah, God will see him vindicated. And though Saul's after him and is hot on his tracks, David's confident because his enemies will be destroyed by God, because God is the one who's going to avenge him. Now you kind of think, well, you've spoiled that for me, because that was my psalm. I used to love reading that and taking that encouragement for me. So what, how are you going to solve that problem then, Tom? Well, let me have a go. This is the psalm of David. Therefore, it's a psalm of the Messiah. Who is the Messiah? Jesus. So Jesus is saying, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. Even though I walk through the valley of shadow of death and all people are against me, I will fear no evil. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint me with oil. It's the King. It's the Messiah. It's Jesus. And although he walks through the valley of the shadow of death, God will raise him up, vindicate him, and ascend him. He'll be ascended to the right-hand side. And his enemies will be his footstool. He is the Messiah. His enemies, he's vindicated, and his enemies are below us. And we're caught up in all that. Our Messiah is up here. And we are representing our Messiah. At which point we can see his enemies are our enemies. And our enemies are under him. So the Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores me, my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. He's vindicated his Messiah. And he vindicates us as well. I hope that makes sense, because I've been destroying it. I hope I've managed to, So I guess that's the thing, so the reason I bring that up, that's the thing with David. It's a lot more complicated than just, because, it's a very genuine question. It's a question you kind of always have, don't you? He's not an ideal person, is David. But in some respects, of course he isn't. He's anticipating the Messiah. And so the more we learn about David and as the Messiah, the more we're going to appreciate, and that's what I was trying to tease out this morning. So he rules with righteousness. How much more then does our Messiah, who rules now, rule with righteousness? Time for a quick one if someone's got a pressing. Simon's going for two. Okay. Well, that's a good question. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, interesting. So, I guess... Yeah, I don't know. How come he doesn't deal with Joab? So, so you've got this... So, Saul is dead. The Amalekite comes and says, oh, look, this is good news, isn't it? I've killed the anointed one. And he says, oh, no, that's not good, you're dead. And then the guys come and say, oh, look, I've killed Ishbosheth. I don't know. I mean, I guess in my mind, this is not a satisfactory answer before I give you it. I guess in my mind I'm kind of thinking in terms of Saul is the anointed one. You don't mess with the anointed one. David wouldn't kill him, so why are you? David has then made a promise to Saul, your children will be safe. And so he then, in righteousness, judges them. And so I guess there's just there's a weight to those two. But for whatever reason, he didn't feel like he needed to. I mean, he curses him, doesn't he? Bless. You remember the promise to Abraham? If you bless me, you'll be blessed. If you curse me, you'll be cursed. In verse 29 of chapter 3, may it fall upon the head of Joab and upon all his father's house, and may the house of Joab never be without one who has discharge, or who is leprous, or who holds a spindle, who falls by the sword, who lacks bread. He's certainly not impressed with him, but he doesn't. So I don't know. The short answer was...